This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Kyra Buckley.
I know what you're thinking. This is the last episode of Colorado Edition. Where is Erin? I had the same question when I got to the station. Well, she is currently at home losing her voice coughing, so send positive healing thoughts. And a big thank you to Kyra for stepping in to help so I don't stumble through this all by myself.
Carly, I'm so glad to be here, but Erin, I hope you get better soon.
Yeah. Well, Erin will be back next week. She and I will be putting together a special episode of Colorado Edition that will feature some of our favorite things from the last year. And it will not be aired, but instead you can find it wherever you listen to your podcasts or on our website, kunc.org. Now, we've put together some really special pieces for you this week. What does the rundown look like, Kyra?
Well, there's a domestic war raging right now across the West and in Colorado against a plant. A small tree called the tamarisk, or salt cedar. But is it really the enemy?
I don't know.
We'll find out later. But then, in Fort Collins, a therapy class for Parkinson's patients is replacing the boombox with a band, and it's getting some rave reviews. We'll also take a listen to the music that nature provides.
And as always, we'll hear a review from our film critic, Howie Mofshevitz. But first, gas prices are falling, unemployment is low, and consumer confidence is fairly high. All of it adds up to what AAA predicts could be Colorado's biggest ever Independence Day travel week. While Denver International Airport will see a surge of travelers, more than 670,000 of them are expected to hit the roads. The worst day for traffic? July 3rd, as holiday travelers from in and out of state mix with commuters. So make sure you are careful throughout your travels.
Oh, definitely. The University of Colorado has a new leader as Mark Kennedy begins his tenure as the 23rd president of the CU system. KUNC's Stephanie Daniel has more.
The Board of Regents unanimously voted Kennedy to be the sole presidential finalist in April. But their decision quickly became controversial due to his time as a Minnesota congressman, where he voted to ban same-sex marriage and increase restrictions on abortions. Kennedy spent a week visiting CU campuses and attending public forums. He was met with protests and tough questions about his voting record. The Board of Regents voted 5-4 to confirm Kennedy as the system president in May. Stephanie Daniel, KUNC.
The Weld County Animal Shelter says it's at capacity and expects the 4th of July holiday week to bring in even more animals.
Starting Friday the 28th and going through Wednesday, July 3rd, the Weld County Humane Society will reduce the fee for adopting an animal that's more than a year old to around $17. To be exact, the fee is $17.76. That's 1776 in honor of Independence Day.
Oh my gosh.
You're welcome. Larimer Humane Society is also offering reduced fees for cat adoptions, and the Boulder Valley Society is waiving fees. That's through Sunday, June 30th.
I really hope some animals find some great, loving, forever homes.
Ooh, yeah, me too.
It can seem like we're on the verge of some kind of war with everyone these days, like trade wars in China or just battling dirty dishes in the kitchen. But we're also waging a war here at home with a plant. The tamarisk, or salt cedar, is taking over waterways in the West, and it's crowding out native species like cottonwoods, and Americans are fighting back. KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle has more.
We've got people crouching in the tall grass, moving around almost on hands and knees, and they're carrying huge knives.
Two more.
The knives are called hori hori, a Japanese tool made specifically for gutting weeds. Others are carrying gardening shears.
So you got a full-on saw.
Yes, the tool of destruction.
But the enemy far outnumbers them. We're in a hot field in Longmont, Colorado, at a volunteer weeding event that's been going on for a few years now. Some people come every year.
It's going to be a few more years before we can kind of give up on this because they're sneaky.
The enemy is the tamarisk, a small tree with a prehistoric look to it, tall, with scaly leaves and tiny pink flowers. They look delicate, but the kind of delicate that makes them indestructible. Like if they got stepped on by a dinosaur, they might just bounce right back up again. It reminds one volunteer of a magical plant in Harry Potter.
You grasp your mandrake firmly. You pull it sharply up out of the pot.
That's what I keep picturing every time I pull one.
People hate the tamarisk. It was brought to the U.S. in the late 1800s for erosion control and also decoration. But as the story goes, the tamarisk has been colonizing waterways, hogging water from other plants, and even salting the earth ever since, choking out native species like cottonwood trees and willows. There are weeding projects like this one going on all over the West. Across the mountains, there's even a state lab that's breeding beetles whose sole purpose is to assassinate tamarisk.
This is a war.
That's Matt Chu. He's a historian of invasion biology at Arizona State University. And he thinks this war is aimed at the wrong enemy.
There's been a concerted effort to demonize tamarisk.
Starting, he says, back in the 1930s, a company called Phelps Dodge wanted to expand a copper mine in Arizona, but didn't have enough water rights. All the local water rights had already been allocated.
What they needed was an excuse to say there was more water in the river so that Phelps Dodge could have more water.
Chu says when they looked at the nearby river, they saw lots of tamarisk. If we can convince people that the plants are sucking water out of the river, they thought, then they could kill the tamarisk and the mine could get the rights to that extra water.
Well, Phelps Dodge did a bunch of experiments, which were later picked up by the Agriculture Department.
And the mine ended up getting its water rights another way. But it didn't matter for the tamarisk. Its image was already destroyed. To make matters worse, something big was changing. The way that water was being moved through the West. Anna Scher is an invasive species biologist at the University of Denver.
In order to accommodate many human needs, we have dammed and channelized our rivers.
Which means they're flowing and flooding in ways that are good for the tamarisk, not so good for native plants. Scher agrees with Chu. The tamarisk isn't all bad. In recent years, researchers showed that tamarisk actually uses up the same amount of water as other river plants, including cottonwoods. And it turns out it also provides a good nesting spot for certain birds.
I certainly do not hate this plant, and I believe that it's only behaving badly because of the way that we've managed our rivers.
But that, she says, is not going to change anytime soon. So instead of addressing limited water, which is the root of the war, we're stuck fighting battles with the tamarisk, plant by plant.
It's a new game now with tamaricks here and with the water needs that we have now.
But though the trees might be fire resistant and drought resistant and able to reproduce like bunnies, Scher says those battles aren't totally futile. Her research has found that clearing out tamarisk can make space for native species to regrow. You just have to stay zen about what native plants might come back. They might be drought adapted shrubs and grasses, not shady cottonwoods. And they will most certainly have a tamarisk or two as neighbors. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
Okay, here's a quick question for you.
All right, let me have it.
Would you rather hear your favorite song off of a CD or maybe a download, or would you rather hear it performed live?
I don't think I could live without either because I love vinyl and I love going to concerts.
I think I agree. But as it turns out, live music isn't just a better experience. It's actually good for you. KUNC arts reporter Stacey Nick has that story.
Femke Verbeek is a music therapy student at Colorado State University, and she knows there's a big difference between this. There she stood in the doorway, heard the mission bell, and this. But for CSU's Moving Through Parkinson's therapy class, Verbeek's version of Hotel California is markedly better. That's not a critique of the Eagles. It's just science.
You like see the change in the way that they're moving.
And that's the key. When recorded music is played, it's easier for participants to just go through the motions. When it's live, they're more engaged.
Instead of just like walking, they're kind of like swaying a little bit more and they're starting to sing along, and that's just nice to see.
Decades of research has already shown that listening to music causes the brain to release dopamine, the so-called feel-good hormone. It also helps decrease anxiety, lowers your blood pressure, improves your memory. Music can even help you deal with pain better.
So music can be magic.
That's CSU music therapy professor Kyle Wilhelm.
But just listening to music doesn't do this all by itself. You know, there has to be something there facilitating it to make it as effective as it possibly can be. And that's where live music comes in.
Studies have linked listening to live music to increased energy levels for cancer patients, improved engagement in people with dementia, and lower stress levels of premature babies. Why exactly is still being researched? But with Parkinson's patients, the answer is more direct. Wilhelm says it all comes down to rhythm.
We can emphasize a strong beat that activates the motor areas better than a weak beat.
That means the musicians, who are also music therapy students, use a lot of percussion instruments to help participants as they move from small motor tasks to more full-body movements, including simple dance steps. There's also the less scientific benefits of listening to live music.
You can dance the Bee Gees at home all you want, but it's not nearly as pleasurable as when you work with a group.
70-year-old Billy Polakowski has been taking the class for the last 4 years. For Polakowski, who spent so much time sitting when she was first diagnosed 6 years ago that she couldn't stand up without assistance, the difference has been life-changing.
It took a lot to get to this point, but sitting in the chair will put you in a chair permanently.
Singing is another way she and her classmate, Susan Coulter, incorporate live music into their therapy.
Because if you lose these muscles, that's when you can't swallow. And most Parkinson's patients will die of aspiration pneumonia because you lose your ability to swallow. And that's the reason we sing badly.
I don't think it's so bad.
Well, it's bad for me, but she is a soprano and does quite well.
Coulter sings in the silver tones. The Fort Collins Choir specifically aims to improve the health of seniors through singing.
When you sing with a group, everything synchronizes.
Recent studies show that when people attend concerts or sing and perform music together, their brain waves and heart rates actually do sync up. It's almost like choreography on a physiological level. Song choice also plays a role.
The best song is the client's favorite song.
Again, CSU music therapy professor Kyle Wilhelm.
And it's the best song because they're going to be the most engaged in it, and they're going to work with it more. Their brain's going to fire more because there's going to be memories that are going to be associated with that song.
In a class like this, where most of the members are elderly, music therapy student Femke Verbeek says that means tunes from the 50s, 60s, and 70s are big hits.
A couple of weeks ago, I did It's My Party by Leslie Gore, and it was a party in here, too. They were like, oh, this brings me back to high school, and it was just nice to hear all their memories through the songs, too.
For KUNC, I'm Stacey Nick.
Kyra, I know this is the first time you've jumped in to help with Colorado Edition.
I know, and unfortunately, it's the last episode.
I know. Well, this is the part where I usually talk about weather, being outside, hiking, or some other shenanigans with Aaron.
Okay, so what do you want to talk about today, then?
Well, do I even need to mention the snowpack or the snow on the first day of summer?
No, the internet went crazy about that one.
Seriously.
My friends back in Oregon, which, by the way, is my home state. What up, Oregon? They were like, so it's just snowing on the first day of summer in Colorado? And I was like, yeah, stay in Oregon. It's great.
Don't come here. I will always love Colorado. I don't think I could live anywhere else. And I love being outside in all of our crazy weather.
Yeah, I don't have to regularly host Colorado Edition with you to know that, but thanks.
Well, I'm just going to use that as a quick segue to my next favorite piece. If you could stand near a river, you'll hear a symphony of sounds, birds chirping, frogs croaking, and water flowing.
Okay, this sounds right up your alley.
Oh, it definitely is. But it gets better when you think about what it would sound like if the stream itself could be transformed into classical music. KUNC's Luke Runyon found a researcher who's doing just that.
By day, Dave Merritt is a river ecologist for the U.S. Forest Service in Fort Collins, Colorado. By night, he's a musician, and one evening he was messing around in his home recording studio.
And I was in my basement alone with my headphones on.
At the time, he was frustrated. He knows rivers are important, but making other people care is hard. And that's when it clicked. Merritt pulled up the flow data for his favorite river, the Yampa, in northwest Colorado, and funneled it through a program that turns numbers into musical notes.
And I absolutely got chills as I listened to the flood of 1984 in church organ.
He called his wife down, had her put on the headphones, and hit play. Those high notes represent the river's seasonal peak. The Yampa is dynamic, mostly fed by melting snow. The year we're listening to, 1984, was a record wet year. Soon, he started auditioning other rivers and trying out different instruments. When the rivers are low, the music is rhythmic and steady.
I hear a heartbeat of violas and violins and piccolos and cellos. Just a boom, 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 boom. And as a monsoon or a snowmelt hydrograph begins to form, you can hear other instruments picking up, and you can hear the rate of the playing of these instruments speed up and vary.
Been measuring the flow of some Western rivers for more than a century, which Merritt says gives us the opportunity to hear how we've changed them. Take a river like the Green, which starts in Wyoming and snakes through Utah and Colorado. In 1962, the Green didn't have any large dams, and its flow hit lots of highs and lows. But just a few years later, the Flaming Gorge Dam was finished near the Wyoming-Utah border, and here's how it sounded after that.
Here's a river, and here's a river in its unaltered state, playing symphonies from year to year, and this is what it sounds like under regulated conditions. You know, it's undeniably different, and it's undeniably had an effect on the organisms in those systems. And this is a way for you to hear it and hopefully to feel it.
He says rivers in the West are meant to surge, either from snowmelt or monsoon rains, and not run steady year-round. The birds, fish, insects, and plant life that call rivers home have evolved to be in sync with a river's rhythm.
We are aware of the consequences of damming and diverting a vast majority of the streams in the West. Then I think society could rally behind protecting one or two.
Dave Merritt says he's not naive to the fact that dams are part of what make life in the West possible, storing water for later use. But now we have the ability to manage our existing dams better and hold on to some of the last remaining free-flowing rivers, like the Yampa.
It's like a natural laboratory. It's something that we ought to treasure and protect like a piece of art. Or like a great symphony.
I'm Luke Runyon.
Colorado's definitely a great state to be outdoors in if you want to have a visual and audio experience.
Oh, absolutely.
KUNC's Michael DeJuana found that out when he produced this audio postcard. It's from right here in our Rocky Mountain National Park backyard. It begins with Jacob Job, a research associate at Colorado State University, describing his search for elk on a cool fall morning.
Quite the contrast to what our weather has been lately, and he was with his assistant, Carlos Linares. Job says they were not armed with rifles, but with microphones.
The Moraine Park is on the east side of the park. It's one of the first sort of features that you'll come to once you enter the park, and it's this big, flat meadow expanse that is surrounded on all sides by mountains. It's a hot spot for birds, but during the fall, it's sort of one of the convergence zones for a lot of the elk. It absolutely is like hunting without a firearm, except my firearm are microphones, and I'm just capturing the sounds of what's going on. My prey is sound, and I take it home with me on memory cards. Carlos and I woke up at 4:30. Carlos is my field assistant. He is a student that works in the listening lab at Colorado State University. We quickly packed everything up, walked down the trail, set the microphones as far into the meadow that we could before there's a river there, a really swampy area. And so it just felt right to me, even though it wasn't light out yet. It's still dark, but we can hear animals on three sides of us, and behind us is a mountain, and we knew they weren't going to be coming from that direction. I had no clue we were there because the wind was blowing into our face. Carlos was behind a tree. He was sort of positioned to where he could just see out the one side, and then I was behind a fallen log. And we just sat, hit record, and what happened next was nothing short of magic. It's still dark, but we can hear elk on all three sides of us slowly getting closer. And eventually the sun starts to come up and we start to see that, you know, these elk are within 75, 100 yards. Two of the males just lock antlers and start fighting, and you can hear the antlers banging into each other. They're breaking willow trees over. You can hear the splashing of the water, the suction of their feet in the muddy ground. Eventually, one of the males was a winner. He was so charged up, he continued to chase all the females even closer to us until eventually they got to within 15, 17 yards, which is really close. This low, guttural glug, this glug, glug, glug. You don't get to hear it that often. A, it's not that loud of a sound, and B, it's only when they're really worked up and they've got a bunch of females that are sort of corralling. The females abruptly turned back towards the center of the meadow, which was a great thing because all of a sudden the sort of the threat towards us was moving away from us, and that's as close as they got. They sort of turned around, but as soon as that happened, 30 yards over our back shoulder, we could hear all of a sudden a coyote start barking. Females saw the coyote, were so threatened or unsure about it, they started giving this really loud alarm bark, which I'd never heard of. It's so loud. And so you've got all of this going on, and it was just like a perfect storm of natural sounds right there, and all of this without any sort of interruption from vehicles, from aircraft overflights, from people. I mean, it was ours, and you just don't get that very often.
That was CSU Research Associate Jacob Job talking about his work recording wildlife sounds at Rocky Mountain National Park. You can learn more about it at KUNC.org.
A new documentary called The Spy Behind Home Plate tells about the life of a shadowy man named Mo Berg. For KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, the film is both fascinating and frustrating.
Mo Berg was born in 1902. His Jewish parents had immigrated to the United States from Eastern Europe during the great waves of Italians, Jews, and others in the late 1800s. Berg grew up in New York, astonishingly got accepted to Princeton, which had quotas for people like Berg, and eventually went to law school at Columbia University. He'd studied languages at Princeton and was good enough that many say he spoke a number of them like native speakers. That talent served this country well during World War II, when Berg became a spy, who eventually got to meet the leading German physicist Werner Heisenberg in Switzerland. Berg was prepared to assassinate Heisenberg, but held off when he realized that the man was not dangerous to us. In the film, Heisenberg's son, also anti-Nazi, thanks Berg for allowing himself to be born. As for the title of the movie, The Spy Behind Home Plate, this remarkable man was also a baseball player, and no ordinary player either. He couldn't hit, but he was a terrific defensive catcher who played major league ball for 15 seasons. He was sometimes called the brainiest guy in baseball and once wrote a fine article analyzing the complicated relationship between pitchers and catchers. Supposedly, Casey Stengel, legendarily bizarre himself, called Berg the strangest man ever to play baseball. All of this information and this remarkable story comes through in Aviva Kempner's documentary. I just wish it came through better than it does. She's got some tough hurdles to get over. Berg apparently had a spy-like personality all his life. There's lots of film and photography of him, but he doesn't talk much, and certainly not about himself. You can see him throw and catch, sit in Japan in a kimono, socialize in a tuxedo, but for the most part he doesn't speak. Berg was known for putting index finger to lips in a hush gesture. He died in 1972, and many of those interviewed in the movie are also long gone. That's no terrible problem either, because somebody had the foresight to interview Berg's brother and sister, men he'd played with in the 20s and 30s, and even children of men he'd played with. Former CIA Director William Colby died in 1996. And there are some recent interviews. Brad Ausmus, manager of the Los Angeles Angels, Bud Selig, the former commissioner of baseball. But the movie generally doesn't mention when interviews were done, so for a time you might think, gee, Berg's brother looks pretty good for a guy, wait, who would be nearly 120 years old now? You get bogged down wondering what took place when. Director Aviva Kempner doesn't look deeply beneath the surface of Mo Berg's life, but you can ferret out that he lived his life as a distinct outsider. As a Jew, he was a rarity in Major League Baseball. Princeton students were also uncommon in the majors, and so were law students and lawyers, and most of all, spies. And he had that spy personality, or at least what I imagine might be a spy's personality. Berg observed more than he participated. He had a film camera, this was in the 20s and 30s, and he took images of his fellow players on the field and on trips. Maybe a film about a spy should be elusive and uncertain. Berg never wrote a book about his experiences, never did an interview with NPR, never ran for office, and apparently never told all to anyone. But the film does leave you frustrated. I want to know more. Where those unlabeled interviews with relatives took place, and under what circumstances? Why did it take so long for them to wind up in a movie? Is the record of Mo Berg's spy career open to the public, or is it classified? And if that's the case, what might be concealed? What's the scoop about this phenomenal man? For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
And on that note, we are out of here.
What? That's it? We're done?
I know. It's over.
Ah, Carly, it's been so great hanging out with you.
Kyra, it's been awesome to have you here with me. Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana.
We also heard Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, and other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from our KUNC members. Thank you. Make sure you look next week for the special wrap-up of Aaron's and my favorite Colorado Edition moments. This is the last weekly episode of Colorado Edition, produced by me, Carly Huckles.
And me, Kyra Buckley. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Jackie High, who manages digital, and Aaron O'Toole, who cheered us on from home.
Thank you for a year and a half of news and fun. Thanks for tuning to Colorado Edition.